So in order to please Colleen, I shall begin with the necessary apologies for my English accent. That is to say, a French one. And according to the composition of the audiences, I used to compare it with Maurice Chevalier for the elder, to Gérard Depardieu for the younger, and to Antoine de Caunes for the British audiences. And sometimes with Princess Catherine in Henry IV, when she said, le français que vous parlez, il est meilleur que l'anglais lequel je parle. I would like to thank very warmly Lauren Clay and Catherine Crawford, the program committee, the local arrangement committee, for having organized such a friendly event. I am deeply moved to see in this hall so many students, colleagues, and friends I have met and I am still meeting on each side of the Atlantic. I cannot name them. It would be to read quite half of the participant index in the program. But I can recall some of the places already mentioned by Lauren where I met them during courses or seminars. Princeton, Berkeley, Yale, Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Chicago, and Philadelphia, where I spent all my spring term. It's not always spring, but it's a spring term since 2001. I also met many of you during the several annual conferences, during several annual conferences of the Society for French Historical Studies, in Rochester a long time ago, in Washington for the bicentennial of 89, at Columbus, Phoenix, St. Louis. I do not forget, of course, our meetings in Paris and the fact that many of the colleagues who are here today have participated in my seminar at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, either as students completing their PhD or as visiting guests. For me, this history is not ended, and it will continue with new generation of American scholars. And I would mention that two of the communications presented in this conference are given by two students of the University of Pennsylvania, Drew Starling and Michel Schatz, I met every Tuesday afternoon in my graduate class at Penn. I quote too often Pierre Bourdieu for ignoring the pitfalls of biographical illusion. That is to say, on the one hand, to transform into destiny what was a series of contingencies, coincidences, meetings, opportunities. And on the other hand, to ascribe to personal invention what was collective and shared intellectual trajectories. As wrote Bourdieu about ego history, l'ego histoire, I quote, one is not necessarily doing academics a service or a service to history, asking the academics to write unmethodical histories of uneventful lives. Des histoires sans, des, to écrire sans méthode, des vies sans histoire. Bob Lynn and Colin's clairvoyance allows me to avoid such a trap today. It is also the reason why I have conceived of this session as a forum allowing to debate common issues. Inspired by the intervention, for some of them I might have read before and we just listened to, I would like to discuss three of these issues. In the beginning were the numbers. Bob's remembered us the French golden age of quantitative history and statistical approach I shared until what he called the big change of 1982. He brought me back to his devastating criticism of the incoherent or insignificant statistical data gathered in Livre et Société dans la France du XVIIIe siècle, a review he wrote and published in Daedalus in 1971. The French enthusiasm for the histoire sérielle au troisième niveau, shared by the conservative Pierre Chenu and the Jacobin Michel Vauvel, was severely shaken by this review that developed in his own manner the parallel critiques made by Franco Venturi or Carlo Ginzburg. It took us a certain time for accepting them, as said Bob, But we did it, and perhaps sooner than it was sometimes affirmed. With other French historians, I was convinced that if series and percentages can indicate fundamental mutation or social inequalities, we needed to shift from distributions to appropriation, from norms to practices, from circulation to interpretation. The history of books and reading was a privileged field, but not the only one, for such fundamental mutation. But we can perhaps consider today that this controversy had something of a faux débat. Whereas French cultural historians have largely abandoned quantitative approach, statistics remained robust, essential in many works devoted to book history. For example, Bob's magnificent volumes on the circulation of forbidden bestsellers and clandestine literature in late 18th century France. Lynn's acute discussion of the concept of representation recalls us another historiographical conjecture, the moment in which this notion, representation, became quite a synecdoche for the whole cultural history. Are the windmills for Don Quixote. My definition and uses of representation, she described so accurately, were grounded in two books and one journal. Pierre Bourdieu's La Distinction, 1979, Louis Marin's Le Portrait du Roi, 1981, and founded in 1983 at Berkeley, Representations. The collective book, edited by Lynn in 1989, under the title The New Cultural History, was the epitome of this representational term. I already wrote too much about the notion of representation, and I do not want to add another piece to this overabundant corpus so clearly summarized by her. I shall limit myself to three comments. First, against the criticism of the notion held as separating the historian from the truth of what happened, or from the reality of the practices, developed by historians like Ricardo García Carcel or Angelo Torre, I would like to recall that for me the main challenge was to articulate the practices of representation with the representations of practices. It is a title à la Louis Marin I gave to my reply to Angelo Torre in an essay published in Quaderni Storici in 1996. Against the bien maigre idée du réel, as denounced by Foucault, we must think that the representations are not simply accurate or misleading images of a reality exterior to them. They possess an energy, a reality of their own that persuades or desires to persuade that the world, the past, or the society are indeed what they say or show they are. Against the illusion of the possibility of an immediate access to the past, we must decipher the logics governing the multiple discourses that describe, depict, regulate, prescribe, proscribe, prohibit the practices that are their object and that are organized according a non-discursive logic. It is why cultural history is always situated, Pache Colin, on the edge of the cliff, and why the desire to write a history of the practices is perhaps a challenging oxymoron. It is also the way I understood the tension between discourse and practice. Even if, unfortunately, I gave this impression particularly to Jonathan DeWald, my aim was not to identify discourse with power and practices with resistance. As underlined by Foucault, non-discursive practices can be disciplinary and punitive, whereas some discourse can be liberating. And as stressed by Bourdieu, the practical sense is not a distinctive social attribute, but a specific logic that governs for everyone the relationship between habitus and situations. Remains Lynn's accurate diagnosis, I quote her, "I do not believe that Chartier has resolved the issue of how culture and society relate." Indeed, such resolution was a little too much for my own expertise. Perhaps for approaching it, it would be useful to consider two definitions of culture. The first one holds culture as a particular domain, field of productions and practices within the social world. Four characteristics singularize it, this cultural field. Its specific values are the economic ones turned upside down. It is defined by permanent struggles about its delineation and boundaries. It is polarized between aesthetic disinterestedness and the logic of the market, or put otherwise, between l'art pour l'art and the literature industrielle. And finally, in the cultural fields, the successive pasts are contemporary of the present. The second definition takes culture as, and I quote Goethe, a system of inherited conceptions expressed in symbolic forms by means of which men communicate, perpetuate, and develop their knowledge about and attitudes towards life. Must we choose between Bourdieu and Goethe, between sociology of fields and interpretive anthropology? Perhaps not. If we want to articulate particular aesthetic or intellectual productions and experiences with the languages, the ritual, the everyday life conducts, thanks to which a society, a social milieu, an individual lives and reflects his or her relationship to the world, to the sacred, to the other, and to itself, himself or herself. Both Lynn and Bob established the list of my main inspirations, Foucault, Bourdieu, Elias de Certeau, and a few others. As we know the profound differences or positions between them, it looks as if I was one of the last disciples of Victor Cousin's eclecticism. Perhaps. But what was important for me was to avoid a singular and orthodox intellectual affiliation, whatever it may be, and the possibility to work using in my own researches some concepts or category rigorously framed by one or another of these classics. For example, the concepts of struggle of classification and symbolic domination coined by Bourdieu, or the auto function as defined by Foucault, or the relation suggested by Elias between civilized psychic economic and classic aesthetics. Beyond this appropriation that are, I hope, faithful and relatively inventive, it is true that I have often published readings, analyses, comments of major works belonging to different disciplines and different languages in the form of prologue, postface, reviews, and reviews not only in scholarly journal, but also in Libération and then Le Monde. I think it is a condition for opening history to dialogues with its neighbors and for acknowledging our intellectual debts. Sans frontières. Colin's words introduce me to my last remarks. In the book and essay I wrote or published in the last year, I tried to follow the migration of fundamental works between languages, between discursive genres, between different horizons of expectations or reception. It is true that these case studies of textual mobility took me away from French history. They focused on Castiglione, Libro del Cortegiano, Las Casas, Brevissima Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias, or Gracian, Oraculo Manual y Arte de Prudencia. But I can say for my defense, particularly in front of this audience, that in each case, French translations or interpretation were essential and play a fundamental role. Amelot de la Housset translation of Gracian, published in 1684 as L'Homme de Cour, transformed the Oraculo Manual into, I quote Norbert Elias, the first handbook of courtly psychology, whereas the word court never appeared in the Spanish text. Jacques de Migrod's translation of Las Casas, published as Tyranny et Cruauté des Espagnols in 1579, allowed every people, every nation threatened by the Spaniards to identify itself with their first victims, the Indians transformed into martyrs. And Jacques Collin and Gabriel Chapuis' successive translation of Castiglione struggled for introducing in French a new word, sprezzatura. Collin translated it as nonchalance, Chapuis as mépris, both giving, as Castiglione did, a distinctive and aristocratic meaning to a word generally understood as depreciative. This example shows, perhaps, how French history can be located within an historiographical perspective I call connected textual histories. Other examples I dealt with are the translation, the festive and theatrical adaptation, the images that introduced Don Quixote in France between the first translation by César Houdin in 1614 until the posthumous and very unfaithful one by Florian printed in 1799. Or, as we have discussed this morning, Molière's appropriation of the previous Festin de Pierre, either French or Italian, for his own play, published as Don Juan in 1682. In a kind of parenthesis, but in order to follow up something which was proposed by Colin, I would like to come back to one of the fundamental ideas, which is perhaps the discontinuity since the 18th century on between two regimes of production of the literary, with or without quotation mark, text. Because it's clear that the order of literary discourse established in the 18th century is founded on the individualization of writing, the originality of the work, and the concept of intellectual property. These three notions achieve their association at the end of the century by the time of what Benichou called le sacre de l'écrivain, the time of the fetishistic exaltation of the autograph manuscript, and the time of the obsession for the author's hand that became the guarantee of the work's authenticity. And what we have to think for a previous period, and perhaps as is suggested from our time, is the fact that Shakespeare, Cervantes, and Auser have not composed their play, their poems, or their novel within this paradigm, but within a very different discursive system. It stood on the very different practices, collaborative writing, as was required by the patron, by the company, by the theater entrepreneur, or pursued by the playwright and the writers themselves. The reuse of stories already told, of shared commonplaces, of inherited formulas, and also the continual revision and continuation of ever open work. And in this system, of course, the only property was the property of the bookseller and or printer publisher, and not at all the property of the author of the text. And it seems for me it's with this discontinuity which could we are able to understand the profound differences between these two regimes for the early modern and modern period, and perhaps, as it was suggested, to try to understand better what are the transformations within our contemporary written culture. Sans frontières, the expression or the motto could be perhaps, and it's my conclusion, a nice way to define today our commitments as historians. It recalls us that we must always fight against the enclosure of monolinguistic bibliographies. It indicates that there is no contradiction at all between microanalysis located in particular situations and broader context or connections. And in these difficult times, inhabited by dangerous passions on both sides of the Atlantic, the motto, the expression, obliges us to adopt, I quote, the cosmopolitan point of view advocated by Kant in 1784 in his idea for a universal history. Thank you.